If you look at most spiritual journeys, totally unrelated to the 12 steps, you will see that they tend to fall into very similar patterns. That people in some way hit bottom, in some form of surrender at the beginning somewhere, and then the way that moves seems to fall into that kind of pattern.
Seems like that the hitting bottom, I will stop at you, but it seems like the hitting bottom, that's one of a real issue. Like if I were in your church, then I'd kind of be attracted to being in a mm-hmm. in a group. When I went in, I wouldn't have the sense that I had hit bottom. I don't have that sense, but I could identify something about myself, with ease to mm-hmm. to work on. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't have had the sense that I hit bottom. I was just trying to, try to get better.
Yeah. Well, and if you'd reach that point where you were sick of being where you were and wanting to get better, then maybe that's your bottom. And people come in, many people have come in because they're sick of being bored. They're sick of feeling flat. They're sick of not feeling passion for what they're doing. Now, that's not exactly a bottom. I mean, not in the classic AA sense. And yet that's a very important thing. It's a very important thing.
Like so many other things with individuals, I think bottoms are at different places. Highs may be at different places for different people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's pretty normal that not everybody has their bottom mm-hmm. when all of their family gets behind and pushes them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is generally true that when somebody goes into treatment and says, "Well, I decided to come to myself," they decided, but there's a couple, three people behind and pushing with all them.
Just an image that I think is wonderful in one of our groups one time, we were talking about our images of God, and a variety of things came up, and one of the women who came in as a result of recovery from a mastectomy, and that was what brought her in, her fear of death, and her image of God was what I hit when I hit bottom. It was what I landed on. that somehow you don't keep falling. That all of a sudden you hit something, and my gosh, it's wonderful to finally hit something. That bottom was God. And that fits in with the sort of ground of our being image of God and so on. That's kind of a nice image to keep in mind.
In your Shalom group, do you talk about confidentiality and not?
We have a welcome that we read every night in our starter groups. We have 8-week starter groups, and people that have gone through the 8-week session can then plug into one of the ongoing groups if they want to. And we have a welcome that we read every night in that, and most of the time in our ongoing groups, that has a whole paragraph on confidentiality. And of course, you can't.
No, you can't guarantee it.
You can't guarantee it. Yeah, but we do. And occasionally people will say, "Now I know that I can trust you all," as a way of saying this is something that is really confidential. A lot of the stuff, isn't necessarily stuff that people would care that much about, but some things are, and that is important to be able to trust. Yeah. Any other questions from other times? If not, we'll chug along. I wanted to start with the story, which I'm sure you all know, but maybe have not ever thought of in this light. We're doing the 8th and 9th. Oh, roll the tape. Hi, Steve. Mary Nelson doing step 8 and 9. Okay. The story of Zacchaeus. And I think this is a very wonderful 8th and 9th step story. The 8th and 9th step... for those of you who don't have a 12-step sheet handy, we make a list of all persons we have harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. And the 9th step, we make direct amends to such persons whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. So the story of Zacchaeus is in Luke 19. He entered Jericho, this is Jesus, and was passing through it. A man was there named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was rich. He was trying to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not, because he was short in stature. I was thinking of that song our kids used to sing. How did that go again? Wee little man was he. Yeah. Yeah. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree to see him, because he was going to pass that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. Jesus asks to come in. Right? So he hurried down and was happy to welcome him. This is Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus hurried down and was happy to welcome Jesus. All who saw it, of course, began to grumble because what was Jesus doing once again? Fraternizing with the sinners. And Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, look, half of my possessions, Lord, I will give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay back four times as much. Then Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, because Zacchaeus too is a son of Abraham. The Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. What struck me about that was, first of all, that Jesus never gives to Zacchaeus a lecture. He never says to him, you are obligated to make amends, to repay, to undo what you have done that is wrong. There is no pressure or force involved in this. Jesus treated Zacchaeus with wonderful love and respect. And Zacchaeus changed. And I think it's a kind of delightful joyfulness with which Zacchaeus comes up with this plan to make amends. That he's going to do for those he has hurt all that he can do. He wants to make this compensation. It's the same kind of joyfulness with which we can approach the eighth and ninth steps. I think that if we're feeling at the end of this talk, when we start talking about people who we've hurt and the ways that we've hurt them, if it feels oppressive, if it feels joyless, if it feels like an obligation, then probably there's some need to go back and work on steps probably 4 and 5, 6 and 7, you know, that you're not ready to do this yet. Because when you finally get to the point of the eighth and ninth steps, this kind of amend-making should be a wonderful, joyful task and not dutiful obligation, gutting out, taking care of this thing. A quick review for those of you who have not been in on this for other lectures. We begin our 12-step journey by turning from blaming everything and everyone around us in our worlds for all our problems to taking a good, strong look at ourselves, at our own behavior, and that has been and continues to be counterproductive. Our own attachments and addictions, all of those things that distort us, that keep us from living out the image of God in which we were created. And the image of God that I've been focusing on in these lectures is a God of work and of love, a God whose work is energized by love and whose love is manifested in work. Now, we also can live that way with this wonderful, energized activity and strivings and being empowered by love and not by all of the other kinds of things that so often empower us. Fear, anger, resentment, our personal strivings, and so on. So the first step is that step when we give up, we admit our powerlessness, and we then in the second and third steps turn to a power greater than ourselves to help to restore us, to help to draw us into that image of God. Through a fearless moral inventory and confession of all that we have done, we wipe away the pain and the guilt of the past, and that's the fourth and the fifth steps. And those are very powerful, important steps to take. And a lot of people in 12-step programs never quite get around to doing those things. And it's too bad, because you're missing a wonderful gift that you could be given. And during that process of the fourth and fifth steps, We usually discover that we have certain cracks in our foundation or holes in our roofs, or the image we used was a house that was kind of in bad shape. And that these defects of character all have a positive kick to them. And so to be ready to have God remove those defects of character, we need to be willing to give up whatever the positive kick is that those defects are giving us. And that was what we talked about last night. So after all of this time, when most of our focus, with the first step through the seventh step, our focus has been on ourselves. It's been a time of great self-absorption, you might say. But now it's time to look around us again and to look at the people whose lives our lives have touched. And many times we have touched these lives in a way that has not been helpful, because we have not been healthy people. And so we have hurt a lot of the people that we live with. The eighth step asks us that we think about going back as far as we can in our lives, and we think about the people that we have come in contact with and the ways that we might have hurt them, and to make a list of those people, to just write their names down. It's a very concrete, task-oriented thing to do, to start writing down the names of people that you've hurt and the ways that you've hurt them. The first question I think that we need to ask, and that's what I want to work on tonight a little bit, is how do we know whom we've hurt? What are the ways that we can hurt people? I mean, there's some things that are obvious, and we could come up with those quite easily. Some things are not so obvious. And so I want to do some brainstorming again, and I came up with a rule of thumb, and I don't know how good this is. We can see how workable it is, but this is what I came up with. Anytime we interfere in any way with the growth of another, now that growth might be a person's spiritual growth, a person's mental growth, a person's physical growth, or a person's emotional growth. Anytime we interfere with the growth of another, we've hurt them, and we need to do what we can to make amends. So, do we have a secretary for today? Anybody want to? No. We need somebody at the chalkboard. We're going to brainstorm.
Can you read your definition once more?
Anytime we interfere in any way with the growth of another, and that growth could be physical, spiritual, emotional, or mental.
But those are the only ways you can hurt a person, or, I mean, well, I've done quite a few fifth steps, and I think of all the theft that goes on from people in your own family to continue a drug habit.
How does that hurt? How does that hurt the person when you steal from them? You begin not trusting. You become suspicious. I mean, it really alters the emotional. I mean, the thing itself isn't important, but what it does to the relationship and what it does to the people. I mean, as a parent, if your kid is stealing from you, a variety of things happen to you.
Yeah.
Not the least of which is that you feel guilty because you've raised a kid that steals. You know, I mean, didn't I teach him right from wrong? You know?
I don't know.
You turn in on yourself. Yeah.
If a material aspect should be included, I guess I look at people addicted to cocaine who steal from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people from whom they have no attachments.
Right. And those people, something we were talking about theft as being a grief thing in the grief session. I don't know how many of you were there. That when you have things stolen from you, it takes you a while to get over it. To start trusting people again. You know, if your house is burglarized, it takes you a long time to feel safe in that house again. So your emotional makeup is hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. I can do this, but my penmanship is horrible. Okay, let's start throwing out. We can start with physical abuse. That's probably the most obvious thing, is that you hurt people if you physically abuse them. What else? Just throw out. Emotional or verbal abuse. Sarcasm. Do you know what that word means, the root of it? It's tearing flesh. Yeah.
Lying.
Mm-hmm. Dishonesty of any kind. Yeah. What are other ways? How about gossip?
Manipulation.
Good one.
Like some humor is very cutting with dependent people.
Cruel humor. Oh yes. That put that, that has put downs embedded in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why don't we call it put down? Put down. That could come in either humor or other kinds of ways. Yeah.
Well, it's almost like they do it in a humorous way so that the other person doesn't get angry at them. Mm-hmm. In a group setting.
Mm-hmm. And yet the thrust is there.
And you can,
and you know it.
And it's very caustic.
Very caustic, yeah. What was the word we were talking about today? Acerbic.
Acerbic?
Acerbic humor. Yeah.
Spelled A-S-C-E-R-B-I-C.
No, it isn't. It's
A-C.
We were trying to look it up. And we couldn't find it. We do these word things at home. How about envy? When you envy another, you alter the relationship in strange ways. And what happens if you know somebody envies you? What do you do?
You try to pull away or make yourself look
smaller. You often will try to minimize yourself.
Distance.
Or you distance yourself. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of very beautiful people will try to minimize themselves, so that people won't be envious of them. Yeah, that's hurting them. Okay.
Blaming.
Blaming others, right. A good one. Ingratitude maybe is one. How about being busy or stressed all the time? What do you say to people when you're busy? Hmm? What do you communicate? You communicate, leave me alone. You communicate, what else? Right, exactly. You are less important than whatever it is I'm doing. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I hate that when I get that signal when somebody says, I was a calling, but you're so busy. Then I got to look at myself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I got to see what signals I'm giving off about that.
Mm, exactly.
It does affect other people.
Mm-hmm.
Very severely.
What about being a caretaker? What do we do to the people around us when we take over too many of their responsibilities? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the opposite of that is being irresponsible, I guess. When we don't do enough. Yeah. Then we communicate that they're not important. And that, yeah.
Neglect,
yeah, that would fall in there. Yeah. And that could be emotional neglect, physical neglect. I was just reading. I sit down in the bookstore. There's so many wonderful books, and I can't buy them all. And so I sit and I read paragraphs here and paragraphs there. And I was reading in one of the codependent books today about people who are addicted to religion. And one of the things that most often happens in the home is that they neglect their children because they're so busy with their church. That there's a real neglect, and it's always justified because it's for God.
Work.
Yeah. Yeah.
You probably don't recommend people just read a paragraph in your book,
don't
you? Yeah,
no, buy it. Good one. Was that acerbic?
I'm not sure, but we'll find one.
What is more? Do we have ingratitude here?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you could have that. Okay, what else?
I don't know if this would fit in that, but I often wonder if someone is disloyal in a relationship and they tell their partner, come back and tell them. I don't know if I would be wording that or not.
Which one of those is worse?
We're going to talk about that more in the ninth step. Yeah. Yeah.
Impatience,
did you say? Yeah, impatience. Good. How about the need to get even, to pay back? you know?
Revenge.
Revenge, yeah.
Withdrawal.
The silent treatment, oh yeah.
Withdrawal?
Yeah.
That can be powerful.
Belittling?
What?
Belittling.
Belittling? Yeah, that's part of put down, isn't it? Yeah, fits into that general category. How about being selfless or being a martyr? Mm-hmm. You really get a claw in people that way, don't you?
I can see all of Jerusalem from here.
Yes.
So I had a pastor friend whose secretary, when he got into his martyrdom, would come in and do that to him.
Yeah.
That's straight to the point.
That's a good one. How about competitiveness? Mm-hmm. The competitiveness with people? Or advice giving, do we have that up there? What do we say to people when we give them advice?
If I were you.
No. You're really too stupid to figure this out for yourself, so I will tell you. It's very, I mean, talk about a put down.
And we then look at this list. Our lists are going to be so long. How do you refer any commandments to 500 people or, you know?
Yeah, and if it feels oppressive, then let it go for now. Yeah, if it feels oppressive, let it go. When it starts to feel like you want to do it and like it's fun and like it's a joyful task, then it's time to do it. Yeah. And that comes when you're feeling really good about yourself. You know.
Is this a time for a question?
Sure.
In the sense that family members, you might have done more than one of those things. So you list them?
List what you've done.
May I read my scroll? Do you make a general comment? How? Am I making sense? I'm not sure.
Well,
the time I was impatient with you last Friday, and then when I did this on last Tuesday,
We're going to be talking in just a minute about how we go about making amends. First, I wanted to get us focused on the ways in which we can hurt people. There's all kinds of subtle ways that we do hurt the people. Any more things we need to add to the list? Stinginess, do we have that up there? And that stinginess could be with our money, possessions, time, energy, just that sense of tightness, stinginess. Communicate something pretty negative. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a term for what we call two-faced, where you're a nice person and then behind their back, boy, he or she is really in
tough.
Or something like that.
Yeah. Two-faced. How about two-faced? Yeah. I like two-faced.
It's all like it is.
Oh.
Well, hypocritical, I guess. That's probably.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you can think of?
Any controlling?
Oh, we need that on there somewhere. A lot of these are controlling things, but like being a martyr is a very controlling thing. But caretaking is controlling. Being bossy. Ignoring? Is that the same as neglecting? Not necessarily.
Ignoring what he says.
Oh!
Oh,
Gary.
Be assertive, yeah. Must I make amends? Yeah. Good. Okay, good,
right.
Thank you. A little hand for the secretary.
Yeah.
I think I was getting a little bit of this from you, but it can really be overwhelming when we first start to think about it. And it seems as though it would pour a lot of self-doubt and a lot of deprecation upon ourselves when we start to do this before we're ready. But when we're ready, then it really feels good. It really feels good. In the same way that Zacchaeus had that kind of joyful, I want to do this. I want to do this. And that comes when we've forgiven ourselves. That the forgiveness of ourselves needs to come first. And then we could say, yes, I've done these things. But since I've forgiven myself, I could also reach out to the other. And that's so crucial, that wonderful sense of self-love and self-forgiveness that has to come first. As we think about the people we've hurt, we have to be really sure that we don't take more responsibility than we ought. And that's one of the things that I always tend to do, and I have a wonderful husband who always kind of cuts me off short when I take on, you know, much more than I ought to be taking on in some of these things. For instance, I'm thinking about something that happened in our family. It wasn't necessarily something that I did, but one of the things that our son confessed to us when he was in treatment was that he had deliberately worked to set my husband and I against each other. I mean, he would tell me one thing and he would tell Roy another thing, and you know, that for some reason, whatever reason it was, he wanted to set us against each other. Well, partly because it would get us off his case, you know. Very simple, I guess. He was responsible for making amends for doing that, but he was not responsible for what we did with it. If we had let that destroy our marriage, he would not have been responsible for that, because he could not make us do anything. You know, you cannot make another person do anything. So you can affect another person, but what they do with that, you're really not responsible for. So when you think about making amends, be sure that you're not, you know, taking on way more than what you're really responsible for. That we all are human beings who have free will, and a lot of stuff comes at us, and what we do with that stuff, we really is our own choice as to what we do with it. So you rob another of their personhood by taking on too much responsibility, too much guilt in all of these things. The second part of the eighth step talks about being willing, and in many ways that is like the sixth step, where you're entirely ready, that somehow something needs to happen so that you're willing to make these amends. And you can kind of tell whether you're willing or not, as we've talked already, by how heavy it feels, if it feels good or if it doesn't feel good. The other sort of flags that you can watch out for is that if you have any flicker of, well, he started it, you know. I mean, sure, I did my share, but it was really his fault or her fault in the beginning. If that's a part of your thinking, then you're not really ready. If you need to justify your own behavior, you know, in your own mind, then you haven't forgiven yourself, and then you're not ready. So if you find yourself saying, well, yes, I did this, but it was because of this and this and this, and I'm going to make sure that person knows that it really wasn't my fault, because I wouldn't have done it if these things hadn't happened, you see. I mean, if you find you're doing those kind of mental games, then you need to back up, because then you're probably not ready to move into that kind of amend relationship. The more subtle thing is that I think sometimes if we're not really healthy ourselves, we use these amends in a wonderfully manipulative way. And what we are in fact doing is heaping coals upon the other person's head. Or we're still trying to control the other, so we do this wonderful self-effacement and asking for forgiveness. But what we really want is for them to respond by saying, oh, no, it was really my fault. And, you know, And when they don't, we get angry and frustrated, and you know, so there, being ready to do this is not an easy thing, and it takes a while. But once you're ready and can get started doing these amends, it feels very, very good. Because what it's doing is allowing you to really live in the day, because it's taking care of all the baggage from your past. And in AA, one of the most profound statements is one day at a time. And when you think about what that actually means, to live one day, expectations for their future, you just love and treasure and accept them in the day, for the day. And you do the same thing with yourself. And to walk in that kind of freedom is absolutely astounding. When it can happen. Not easy. Oh. The ninth step calls for action. And now we'll get into what some of you have been asking about. Actually sitting down and figuring out how best to make amends and then going ahead and doing it. There's a caution in the ninth step. It says, except when to do so would injure them or others. And the example that is always given in all of the AA material is the example of marital infidelity. And if it would hurt, if you have been unfaithful to your wife, for instance, and it would hurt your wife more to know than to not know, you know, then you don't tell her. And you find other ways. You certainly quit the behavior. And you find other ways to make amends. Telling the person is not necessarily and always the best thing to do. If you've broken the confidence of a friend, you know, if that friend has told you something in great confidence and you've broken that confidence, it may or may not be the best thing to tell the friend that you have told her secret. You see, because that may cause great trauma for the friend to know that secret is out. It's just hard to know. You know, it's hard to know. But it takes thinking about the situation as God would think, loving these people as God would love them, trying to think of what that person most needs in that situation, and then trying to do it. Always it involves a change of the behavior. So that if you have habitually put people down with kind of cruel humor, of course the best amend that you can make is to stop doing it. And then of course even a better amend is to start affirming them in positive ways, you see. You may not ever go to them and say, I really feel lousy because for years I've been putting you down with cruel humor and I'm going to now quit doing that, and aren't I a wonderful person? I mean, there's a certain... you could get into a kind of self-aggrandizement in that kind of thing too, that sometimes not telling the person is almost a better form because it keeps you out of that pride of what you're doing, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we could, if we had time, and in fact, you all might want to be thinking about which of these things are most closely like the things that you do, and then think about what the opposite would be. So that you can, in fact, have in your mind what the behavior is that you're trying to change toward. And that's, I think, very helpful. It's very helpful. So, you know, the basic question in all of these of these thinking is confession and asking for forgiveness with the assumption that you will not repeat the action always the best way to make amends? And sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. And there really are no rules or guidelines. And here we end up really needing the help of the community. Sometimes we come to our meeting and we say, I need to make amends to this person. I could do this, I could do this, I could do this. Does anybody have any insight? Has anybody been in this situation that I'm in? The community can sometimes help us sort out our own agenda, you know, and if we're really trying to manipulate the other or whatever. Others can...
Theological language is a self-imposed penance.
Hmm?
In theological language is a self-imposed penance. penance is an act of grace in Roman Catholic sacramental theology. And so doing the opposite, and you make the decision to do that, approach that person doing things opposite of what you had done at first time.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways it becomes a self-initiated penance, a gift of grace.
A gift of grace. Yeah, I think so.
One person was talking about making amends one time and wanted to communicate with another person whom he had hurt. And the community talked about that, and one of the suggestions was to write the amend, but not to make it direct like himself, but to have a mutual friend or someone that he trusted to do that. Because for him to do that directly may have initiated some negative feelings again, or could have caused some harm to the other person in that way. So I mean, that's another way, an indirect. And I don't know if that was appropriate or not, but that was kind of a...
Yeah, and there's no formula. There are no hard and fast rules, and it really takes a prayerful, thoughtful, loving attentiveness to the needs of the other. When you set about to do these things, there are some questions that you might be thinking about. There are questions that often come up, and I'll run through them. And then if there are other questions, just flag me. The first question I think that's important to think about is, where shall I begin on my list? And I think the most important place to begin on your list is with the people that you are in most immediate contact with right now. So the people that you're living with right now, the people that you're working with right now, that's where you begin. And then you move out from there to people from your past. You know, sometimes the people have died, and sometimes you really need for yourself to make some connection. I can't remember where we were talking about this, people that have gone to gravesides and read letters or talked to people that have died, because they have just needed for themselves that release, because they know that they have badly hurt somebody, and there's no way to make amends. The person is dead. What we do as honestly and as lovingly as we can, and then we let it go. And the response of the other is not our problem. And that's really tough. But the response of the other is not our problem. I remember when we moved to Iowa City, we left our oldest son in Minnesota in college, and he was at that time really seriously working his program. He was 2 years out of treatment by that time and doing a lot of things. And one day our younger son got a letter in the mail, and I saw him reading it, and he read it, and I don't think he ever even finished it, and he wadded it in a ball and hurled it across the room and stormed out of the door, slamming the door behind him. And of course, something I still haven't made amends for, I will someday. And it was our older son's amends letter to the younger one, telling him how sorry he was for all that he had done and how horrible he felt for the way that he had hurt his life. But the younger one wasn't ready to hear that because he was still hurting too badly. And it really was another couple of years before he could hear it. And then he remembered the letter. And now they have an incredible relationship. But sometimes the people that we've hurt are still really hurt. And just because we're feeling good about ourselves, that almost makes the hurt worse. You know, it's like rubbing salt in the wounds when we come all forgiven and glowing and joyful and, you know, and say, you know, I hurt you and I'm sorry. And they're still deeply involved in that hurt. So their response is their response. And we have to let go of that. And just pray that what we have done will work somehow for their healing. Another question is it important to tell people about how my behavior has hurt them? We've talked about that a little bit, and that I plan to change, or should I just change and let them see the change in behavior? And again, that's a judgment call. Sometimes it's really helpful to people, especially your families, when to say to them, I really hurt you in this way, and it helps them to understand why they're hurting, especially if it's parent to child, because they really have no way of putting that all into perspective. They just know that they feel angry or frustrated or something, but they don't really know why. So sometimes it does help. Other times it becomes a kind of self-aggrandizement, I think. God, the healing is in God's hands. We're not healers. All we are is making amenders. You know, God's the healer.
I hope it'll be okay.
And that child is cradled lovingly in God's hands. And God is going to lead that child on a path that will bring about the healing if you just let go. You know, that God loves that your child more than you do. Bottom line, we hate to think that as a mother, but it's true. And our children walk their journeys, you know. They walk their own journey. And many times the pains that we've inflicted upon them become the wonderful, strong building blocks of their personalities. And God can do that. What about things that you've done that might have been illegal? That was one of the problems that our son faced. And we didn't know that he was doing this. He went back to the town where we lived. And he started, and it was still within the statute of limitations, and he started going around and confessing to people. He traveled in a gang of kids, and they did all kinds of vandalism junk. And, going around telling people what he had done. And, I mean, I'm just glad I didn't know at the time. I would have been a wreck. Because anybody could have brought charges against him. But he needed to do that for himself. And in every case, he said, I am willing to do anything I can to make amends. Can I work for you? Can I repay you? What can I do? You know. Most often the people were so touched by his presence. And particularly with vandalism, you never know if it's personal or not personal. And it always leaves such a horrible feeling in your mind that somebody would wreck your property. And to find out at some point that it had nothing to do with you, that it was just dumb, hopped-up kids, you know. Pear tells this wonderful experience of a farmer who just threw his arms around him and wept because he was so happy to have found out what had happened and to know that it wasn't a personal attack and that it wasn't related to him or, you know, that his neighbors weren't getting even with him or whatever, you know, it is that you assume when something happens. And it was just a very joyful kind of thing that happened with him. That's tough, and sometimes you end up in situations where you do end up in trouble. But you have to do what you have to do to come clean, I think. And again, let the community help you with those kinds of decisions about what to do and what you've done is illegal. Are there ever people to whom I shouldn't make amends? And I think that's maybe what you were getting at a little bit with. There are some people in your life who are still so ill, like a practicing alcoholic or people that are just so emotionally not well that you know that if you came to them with any kind of gesture of amends, they would take it and use it like a skewer and skewer you once again. You know, you just know that that would happen. Sometimes you have to let that go. You have to make sure that your own self is clean toward them and that your behavior has changed. For instance, with an alcoholic father, that you've forgiven that man, that you don't any longer hold resentment toward him, that your behavior has changed toward him. But to actually go to him and say something, you might run the risk of being really impaled again upon his skewer. So again, the caution of the ninth step that except when to do so would injure them or others, you need to think about yourself in that others. That if to do so would really injure you, and you know that that's true because the person is so unhealthy, then just make sure your own self is clean and let that go till the person is healthier. The last thing I want to talk about, and then we might have a little time to get into small groups. What about yourself? More than likely, the person you have hurt the most is yourself in the way that you've lived. More than likely, it's yourself that you most need to make amends to. And you need to think about that. And of course, the whole 12 steps is a way of changing the kinds of behavior that has been hurting us all along. And so in a sense, being involved in the 12-step program is your own amends to yourself. But you need to think about that self and treat yourself as graciously and as lovingly as you treat everybody else. And be good to yourself and make amends to yourself and love yourself in the same way that you try to love other people. Why don't we, let's see, we have 5 minutes left. How would you like to spend it? Are there any general questions or would you like to break down into small groups and talk a little bit? Under what the circumstances were. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I mean, I can't tell you the number of years and the number of hours I spent just ripping myself to shreds for what I should have done, could have done, hadn't done, might have done, you know.
Taking more responsibility for.
Yes. Exactly.
It's only been 31 years.
Yeah. It's just not helpful. You know, I did the best I could, and I raised a drug addict. And he walked through that valley, and God brought him through, and he is now an incredible human being. And the world is better for his presence in it as a recovering drug addict. Well, not telling them is not necessarily being dishonest. It might be the most loving thing to do. If you tell them because you're afraid they're going to find out anyway and get caught, that's something very different from making amends. I mean, that's a fear-based, self-protective thing, and that's just a different thing. And you know, you might want to do that. but that's not this. As a mother, I know that I always would rather hear things from my kids than hear it from the principal or the teacher or the police or whoever, you know. And maybe in the case of a broken confidence, your friend would rather hear it from you than from somebody else and would rather hear it in a spirit of confession and contrition. So you need to... there's no rule, you know.
Yeah, but given that there's no rule, that I find a little ambiguity, and the answer is in the question of doing what's right versus doing what's nice.
Mm-hmm.
If it's left open, and what we're kind of taught in the church is being nice. So when it's kind of left up in the air, we're afraid what we'll tend to do is do the nice thing as opposed to doing the right thing.
When there's conflict. I mean, yeah, it's yeah. Not to necessarily imply that there's always a conflict between the two.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like flipping the coin, and I think the coin will usually wind up on the nice side.
Now, in this case, what would you call nice and what would you call right? I mean, do you feel capable of making a judgment call on that?
It depends on the situation. But I know what I typically think about 12 steps. One of the references you made was doing what God would do.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what I typically think about the 12 steps is doing what I would want somebody to do for me if they were in that situation. Because when I think of God, I think of a nice person.
Mm.
God is skewed through all my experience with the church. So I just, you know, there's just some, you know, there's a danger.
Yeah. There's a real danger in doing to others what you would have them do to you also, because we are all so different. That what I might want to have done to me may not be what another would want done to them. And that, so that really muddies the waters. It took me a long time to figure that out, that to be kind to another is to do for that other what that other as a kind of person would want. The kindness is treating another according to their kind, not according to my kind. And does that make sense? And but you don't always know what their kind is. And I think also to rest, and I think we can rest in it, that a part of living in a fallen creation is that every decision we make is going to have a dark side. There is not anything that we can do that doesn't have its tinge to it. And that's what living in a fallen world means. It means that there is nothing we can do that isn't in some way skewed. Now, that doesn't mean that some things aren't far more skewed than other things. So we do the thing that seems the least skewed, that seems the best, but there's always going to be something about every decision we make that isn't going to be quite right. And that's what it means to be living in this fallen world. And we just have to, that's one of the things we have to accept. Can't fight that one. Any other comments? That's why perfectionists get so hung up. Because they can't live with that. They can't live with it. And so they have to put blinders on, and they have to alter their vision of things, and they have to do all kinds of mental games to pretend that that's not true. And it is. Every decision, yeah. And the wonderful thing that I've discovered as I've grown over the years is how God is able to take my mistakes and turn them for good. I mean, I do something and I've done it, and all of a sudden it's absolutely clear that it was the stupidest thing on earth to do, that it really was a mistake. And when I can go to God and say, I really blew it again, please take this, you know, that God can turn those mistakes for good. So it gives us a wonderful freedom, I think, in our actions. I don't know how many of you heard the Luther person, Stroll, talking about Luther's sin boldly, and we throw that around a lot. But I think that that's a part of that freedom, that God can use the things that we do that are good things, and God can use the things that we do that are mistakes, because God has that kind of power. So we can live with much greater freedom to risk, to step
live
out.
Boldly. Live boldly.
Mm-hmm.
You will sin boldly.
Yeah. Somehow it just happens. Yeah. Any other comments or questions? Well, tomorrow we do the 10th step, which is another good one. This is quite a journey. So, yeah.